Father, we're really grateful that we can worship you today, that you've, as a part of your magnificent creation, allotted this time where we can worship you, where you want to come in and draw near to us. And so, Father, help us to draw near to you today, in Jesus' name. Amen. I've moved over here so I can just have a glance at what's on my computer. Can you all see what's on the screen? Anzac Day 2015. Across the country in a couple of weeks, thousands of people will gather before dawn, and in the cool, in the peace and quiet of the darkness, they will hear the bugle play the last post. It's played at that time to honour the Anzacs who just before dawn, 100 years ago this year, launched their attack on the beaches of Gallipoli. They were there to capture the area that would open the way to the Black Sea for the Allied forces. And Turkey had declared itself for Germany only, I guess, 6 months earlier. They'd seen Germany romp through Belgium, and they decided to join. They thought Germany had a good chance of joining. And so they declared themselves for the Central Forces against the Allies. The plan was to rush through Turkey and to take Constantinople quickly, and it was expected that this one decisive blow would take Turkey out of the war altogether. They amassed 500,000 Allied troops and launched an attack against Turkey. The area there on the Gallipoli Peninsula was being defended by around 300,000 Turkish soldiers. Far less numbers, but with a greater strategic advantage. They held the forts, they held the hills. And they fought to a standstill in what would be known as one of the most brutal and blood-filled battles of the war. On that one day, Australia lost 11,000 of its youngest and finest. Which, when you think about it, compared to the 500,000 they sent, doesn't sound like a lot. But when you think about the amount of people, greater than even the city of Hamilton, being killed on one day, it's greater than any terrorist event that we've ever heard of in our lifetime. Despite the fact that the assault on Gallipoli failed in its military goals, it achieved something else. It cemented the soldiers from Australia and New Zealand, which made up a large amount of the forces, together into a force which, I guess, as was pointed out to me before the sermon, has now achieved almost mythic status in Australian folklore, the Anzacs. And every year, in the biggest parade in Sydney, over 20,000 people march in the Sydney parade. Anzacs and their descendants, there's not a lot left of the Anzacs anymore, but they still are there. And you know, when I was a younger man, I never really understood the big deal about Anzac Day. I mean, I knew what it was historically, but I guess I didn't really know what it had to do with me and why my dad wanted me to get up before the sun was even up, because that was just crazy, right? It's cold out there, it's dark, I don't want to do that. But my dad was in the Army Reserve, so he had the esprit de corps and would get me up and we'd go along to this misty morning service. And it's a spiritual service. If you've ever been to a dawn service, there is undoubtedly a spiritual element to it. It maybe it's replaced church in some ways for the spirituality of some Australians in the same way that football has. I guess the most fun for me was when I got to school and we would go to Anzac Day as a part of school and watch the junior cadets try not to pass out in the sun. I didn't really understand what Anzac Day was about. And it wasn't really until I understood another sacrifice that had been made for us at another time when I began to appreciate Anzac Day a little more. And I guess I didn't really know much about Anzac Day at all. People would go on about it. All I really knew was that World War I had started with an assassination, the assassination of this man, in fact. Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Don't worry, this isn't a history lecture. Well, it is a little bit of a history lecture. You'll see. And Lynette assures me that I haven't talked about this here in Hamilton, and I hope that's true. He was assassinated on the 28th of June in 1914, and Archduke Ferdinand was the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne. And as he was the heir to that country, they promptly declared war on Serbia. War has been going on for a long time in this region, hasn't it? Just when each country stepped into the fray, World War I was officially on because each country called in their allies, and it was a big war. Australia and New Zealand, of course, as allies of England, declared war as well on Germany. Now, in Australia at that time, they didn't have such a thing as conscription. They couldn't forcibly try and make the young men serve in the army. And so they would put up posters like this to entice the young men to enroll. Fall in, it says. Which picture would your father like to show his friends? And of course, up the top, the young proud soldier, and down the bottom, the rakish tennis playing layabout. Which picture would you rather show your father? Who would you rather be? These are very emotive calls. Australia has promised Britain 50,000 more men. Will you help us keep this promise? And today we're going to talk about a story that I've discovered, because if you go onto the website of the Australian War Memorial, you'll discover that a lot of these kind of details are there electronically. And you, in fact, can sit there and look at a lot of these details. And so I'm going to talk about this guy who was one of the young men who felt called to defend his country. Now, these posters came out on the back of Gallipoli, and I can imagine the response that must have come from Australia when so many young people had been killed. They ramped up their recruitment. Those posters are very emotive and strong. And I showed you the nice posters. I didn't show you the virulent anti-Germanic posters that were out there, that are horrific. I didn't want to show the children, to be honest. They're that gruesome. But this is a young man who I thought you might be interested in. His name is Alexander Rankin Macmillan. I guess Rankin was one of those old-fashioned names that you don't hear about anymore. His parents lived in Tasmania. His dad was called Daniel Rankin Macmillan. So there we go, it's a family name. And as far as we know, he was a shipbuilder, while his mother, Florence Effingham Lawrence Macmillan, was a nurse. You like that name, do you? Effingham. I never heard that name before. There we go, Florence Effingham Lawrence. They were married on the 15th of May in 1889 in Beaconsfield. Well, I guess more recently known for a mine disaster. They were married in Beaconsfield. And almost a year later, Alexander arrived, their firstborn son. They would end up having another two sons, Louis the year after, and then Frank, 2 years after that. He's a good-looking guy, isn't he? Or is it just the uniform? I'm not sure. Now, at that time, Tasmania was a pastoral area with a lot of livestock, and by the time the First World War comes around, Alexander had taken up the trade of butcher. Now, here's a picture of him in his butcher's delivery cart, because obviously they didn't have, cars to race around in, and so the butcher would bring the meat to you. You don't see many of these around anymore. Can you imagine when things used to be delivered? Remember when milk used to be delivered? That wasn't that long ago, was it? Records indicate that by the time that Alexander takes his apprenticeship, that his father has died. And in fact, life expectancy in Australia in those days was an average of 55 years, which is quite short when you think about it, an average of 55. So when the war begins, we see Alexander very keen to sign up. So the National War Museum keeps these extensive records. All this stuff is online, and you can look up anyone that you like. And from those online records, I've got a copy of his actual application to join the Australian Imperial Force. Can you see that? Now, I guess with this kind of thing, you've got an opportunity to go back a little in time and see what his life was like. And I want to do this just a little bit, if you'll bear with me. Let's go a little closer. All right. So you can see that he's... Let's have a look. What's his name? Alexander Rankin Macmillan. near the town of St. Mary's in the county of Tasmania. Then it asks, are you a natural-born British subject or a naturalized British subject? Now, it's not the Australian Army, it's the Australian Imperial Force. It's very much still a part of England and the British forces. That's what we're a part of. What is your age? 25 and 3/12, he tells us, making sure that he seems old enough, right? What is your trade or calling? Butcher. So he's a butcher. This is what he does. We can see that he joined on the 3rd of August 1915, not long, only a few short months after Gallipoli would have happened. And you can see, if you look carefully, that he was put in the 12th Battalion. There we go. Let's have a look a little further. All right. Are you married? No. And then he lists his mother as his next of kin. Mother, nurse, she's a nurse. Nurse Florence Adams. She was a nurse. And then it asks, I think, quite interesting. It gets quite into it. Have you ever been convicted by the civil power? Yes, for furious driving. And think about it. This is 100 years ago. There's this young 25-year-old driving a little too fast, perhaps in his butcher's car. What do you reckon, while he's making the rounds? But we also learned that his father's not listed as his next of kin. So sometime in the first 25 years of his life, he's lost his father. And he's a butcher. We're getting a little picture of him here. His mother, obviously working as a nurse to try and raise her 3 sons alone. This can't have been an easy life. Oh, I like the furious driving, by the way. Has he ever been discharged before? No. Have you ever served in it before? No. Have you stated the whole, if any, of previous service? Yes. Have you ever been rejected as unfit for His Majesty's service? If so, on what grounds? Yes. He's applied before. What do you get rejected for? Bad teeth. That was why he was rejected from the army before. Are you prepared to undergo inoculation against smallpox and enteric fever? Yes. They're more desperate for soldiers this time, aren't they? They just lost 11,000 of their finest. They can't afford to be so picky over bad teeth anymore, can they? Here we go. Oath to be taken by a person being enlisted. So he signs and swears that he will serve until the end of the war, so help me God. Taken and subscribed at Claremont in the state of Tasmania. He had to have a medical examination. And Peter, you might want to help with some of this. He was tested for scrofula. Does anyone know what scrofula is? Or phthisis. Apparently they're actually both forms of tuberculosis. Syphilis, impaired constitution, defective intelligence, defects of vision, voice or hearing, hernia, hemorrhoids, varicose veins beyond a limited extent. You could have a few, apparently. Marked varicocele with unusually pendant testicle. This is a thorough exam. This gets interesting down here. Chronic ulcers. Traces of corporal punishment or evidence of having been marked with the letters D or BC. What do you think that might mean? Why would they be looking for someone marked with letters? Deviant. Hey? Deviant, you reckon? In fact, law in the 1800s allowed for human branding. And if you were marked with a D, you were a deserter. BC, you were right, Tony. Bad character. If you had a bad character and had served previously in the military and you were kicked out because of it, you were branded. They didn't have computers in those days. They didn't have a central way to check who was who. So they would literally brand you with BC for bad character. It would be marked 2 inches below the left armpit and it would be no smaller than 1 inch big. Yeah. He's checked his eyes, his heart and lungs, that he has free use of his joints and limbs, and he declares that he is fit for duty. He clears the medical, signs the oath to serve the king and to resist his majesty's enemies and cause his majesty's peace to be kept and maintained. What causes a young man to join the Australian Imperial Forces? What makes a young man living as a butcher with his mother, he would have undoubtedly been helping with the family expenses, what makes him give that up and leave his mother and younger brothers alone in Tasmania? Australia wasn't in any immediate danger. Adventure, maybe. Without his father around, he would have been the oldest son and had the responsibility to look after the family. He must have known the danger that was happening. But maybe he didn't. But maybe the danger was what spurred him on. But there was really no need for this one young man to go. But he made a choice, didn't he? He made a choice to leave where it was safe, to travel far away from home, a choice to try and accomplish something bigger than he'd ever done before, and to fight, if not for the pay, at least for the principle, and for his country, and for his friends. I guess it reminds me a lot of another kind of war in Revelation. And Revelation 12, we know these verses well, don't we? 7-9. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. This is Lucifer, the light bringer, the covering cherub, who next to Christ was the most honored in heaven, the closest in the councils of God. He was prideful though, wasn't he? He wanted more. He believed he deserved more. And yet still the rise of this sin is inexplicable. The Bible itself calls it a mystery how sin could have arose. But we know that in heaven's halls he whispered accusations, he stirred discontent, he turned hearts against God, and he's still doing the same today. Finally, Satan the accuser made his accusations plain, saying that all evil came from God's administration, and Satan tried to claim the right to take God's place. And there was war in heaven. Isaiah 14 tells us this picture. How you are fallen from heaven. Have a look at it if you're there. You know these verses, Isaiah 14. How you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn. You have been cast down to the earth, you who once laid low the nations. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit enthroned on the mount of assembly, on the utmost heights of the sacred mountain. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. How does any war start? You know, Plato said that all wars begin with the comforts of the body. He's saying the reason people want more is so they can be more comfortable and have more things for themselves. And that inner instinct is actually the driving force behind nations going to war. Lucifer brought war to heaven. Can you even imagine those two words in the same sentence? War in heaven. How can it be heaven when there's war? What must it have been like? There'd never been anything like that before. In response, God declares a curse upon Satan and utters the Bible's first prophecy, pointing forward to Satan's ultimate defeat in Genesis 3. His head to be crushed beneath the heel of someone to come. A seed of the woman, someone born from Adam and Eve's line, would defeat Satan. This great controversy has hit new heights. You know, Satan brought rebellion to earth and corrupted God's creation with sin, and he corrupted the human race with sin. And this world became, and still is, a battlefield. So when you think about wars far away and overseas and distant from ourselves, and when you think about yourself being safe at home, consider this, we live in a battlefield. Every day is our battlefield. Our battlefield is the battlefield of our minds. How could the human race be saved? The consequence of sin is death. God is life, and rejection of God means death. The whole planet had been condemned by Satan's sin. But there was one who stood up and volunteered to fight against Satan in this war. Even though he was perfectly safe where he was, in his throne by his father's side, even though Satan had been expelled from heaven, there was one who stood up and decided to go and said, I will go to this faraway land and fight the enemy. Why would Jesus do this? Because we know Jesus was touched with pity for us, for the human race. His divine heart was moved with infinite compassion, and a plan was decided upon to redeem mankind. Christ would take the sin of man upon himself and take the punishment that we deserve. And that really strikes me when I think about the fact that Christ thought about me and you when he knew us before we even lived and said, for them, that's why I'm going. For you, that's why I'm going. He was moved with love for us. That's why he entered the battle. Alexander Rankin Macmillan first had to go through some basic training before he could enter the battle. And he, remember, he signed up in August in 1915. Now, this is some records of his movements. So, you can see here on the 11th of February 1916, between when he signed up in August the previous year, he's made it to Suez. That's what's happened. He's basically spent months in training and on a boat. They couldn't fly people overseas. They shipped them in a boat. And he proceeded to Alexandria in Egypt. This is April by now. This is a year, just about a year. The 6th, so it's only, it's about 99 years ago. And that was on the HMS Transylvania, disembarked at Marseille, in France. So he's gone through to the Suez Canal to Alexandria and then on to France, to Marseille. By this time, it's June in 1916, about 10 months after he's signed up. Now, if you see here, it says he's joined the 1st Entrenching Battalion in France in June. Now, you might say, what's an entrenching battalion? But I didn't know what an entrenching battalion was either. Now, these guys who have been shipped across the world from small towns in Tasmania and other states around Australia have never seen anything like this. You know, we're used to war movies, we're used to talk about war, but before then there'd never, well, there'd been wars, there'd never been anything to the scale of World War I or World War II. So what they found is that people were really struck by battle. They were psychologically affected by it. And so what they had to do was make an entrenching unit a little bit further back from the front where they would make a trench, right? They were close enough to the front to hear the sounds of battle, but they weren't actually on the front where they were fighting. So he's come through Egypt, which would have been an amazing thing to see for a boy from Beaconsfield, right? And now he's at France, at Marseille. And that's where, I guess, he kept his first Anzac Day. So this battalion here, this entrenching battalion, would have been hard. You would hear the constant shelling. You would see some of the graphic details of war. You would live in a trench much like this. So you've got your gas mask on. It's full of mud. And what happens when you put your feet in water all day? They get mudlogged and they get waterlogged, and there's but you get trench foot and your feet get swollen up. And this is just a couple of slides of what you've seen. You ever seen your skin go wrinkly in the shower if you spend too long in the shower? It's like that, but for weeks on end. So, and that's what happens after a while. It's not pretty. Gas warfare was common, so they had to wear their gas masks quite often. And I guess what he must have been going through, what Alexander Ranker Macmillan must have been going through, comes through a little bit in this next slide. I'll just bring this up for you. I found this online as well. It says that here, on the 24th of June in 1916, he was cited for disobedience. So this is the first time that you ever see anything negative or contrary about his record. But he's in the entrenching unit at this time and he's cited for disobedience. It doesn't say what he did wrong. Charged with disobedience. It doesn't say exactly what he did. I don't think it's a coincidence that it happens when he's sent to the entrenching battalion. I wonder if he was afraid to go there. I wonder if something that he saw or heard struck him with fear, and for the first time he felt doubt. When he saw the wounded people, was he scared? The next trace we have of Alexander after this is his death. And it's marked that he was killed in action on the 25th of August in 1916. Now, when you look over here, it actually says 19/22. That means that he was killed in action sometime between the 19th and 22nd of August. There's a 3-day period where he was killed, but no one's really sure what day it happened on. No one's really sure exactly when. A body's never recovered. And if you note that that's just after, or June, he was when he arrived, at the end of June he arrived at the entrenching battalion, and only a few weeks later, after travelling for months around the world, after 2 or 3 weeks in France, he's killed in action. And I can't imagine what that would be like to travel for, this is almost a year after he signed up, remember? He's travelled all the way around the world, and in the last 2 weeks, he's killed in France. Not much else is known about Alexander Ranker Macmillan. At that time, the 12th Battalion that he was a part of was fighting in a French town called Pozières, and this place, historian Charles Bean says, is more densely sown with Australian sacrifice than any other place on earth. The Australians fought at the front there. In a similar situation, I know that I'll be terrified. I guess it's hard to see how he would feel. It would be hard to imagine that he wouldn't be afraid, surrounded by enemies in a foreign land that he'd never seen before, with smoke and blood and noise and death. He must have been genuinely frightened, and yet he stayed and fought. He must have wanted many times to be back in Tasmania with his mother. But despite that, despite his fear, he fought and he died. All that's left was for his mother to receive his personal effects. And that would be it. And his mother asked time and time again for those effects. And we've actually, on record, they've actually got her letters. And I know it's a bit tough to read. If you're interested, I've actually got copies of these with me, if you want to look at them and hold them and read these out. But she's basically writing to ask. I'll read some out for you. Can you give me any information about the death of my son? He was killed in action between the 19th and 22nd of August last. The cable did not state where, but his last letter, dated August 13, 1916, came from France. I would like to know how he was killed and where buried and what became of his personal effects. Would you kindly give me all the information you can? I shall be very grateful, as I, his widowed mother, am now entirely alone. Yours very sincerely, Nurse Florence E. L. Adams. She says, I've had no information about my boy, only that he's been killed in action. You can feel Florence's grief in these letters. A year later, she's still writing, 1917, this is in September, trying to find out exactly what happened to her boy, where his body lays. Time and time they write back to her, but they have no further information, because how do you even tell a mother that there isn't a body, that there's nothing? They don't even know when exactly he passed away. Being a father now, I can't imagine what that would have been like. Eventually, his effects, his personal effects, have been located from his bag, not from his body, but from his kit, and they're sent. One Arabic book. He's got a translation book of Arabic so he could speak to the people in Egypt. He's got a cat comforter, one key chain, one key disc. He's got a New Testament. And he's got a comb. And that is what is returned to Florence Adams. You can see that he was awarded the British War Medal, the Victory Medal, and the Star Medal, killed in action, and it was sent home on the Themistocles, and it was picked up by Florence Adams. It's stark, isn't it? It's just one person out of so many who died. There's in fact a plaque for him over in France. There's a memorial here at Villers-Bretonneux, where there's a lot of memorials to Australians. And to this day, you know, they're still finding remains in France on the battlefields there. And I guess his story really reminds me of another story where in the Garden of Gethsemane, with less than a day to live, Jesus pleads with his Father. He's come to earth and has lived in human form, and now that time is approaching when he has to die. Satan knows that Jesus has come to defeat him. He knows why he's there. He's tried tempting Jesus but failed. He's tried killing him but failed so far at least. But tonight something's different, because here in the Garden of Gethsemane, so far from that garden where Adam and Eve stood and fell, Jesus at this spot takes all the sin of the human race on his shoulders. It's not an easy burden for the Son of God to take on, but he is a good soldier. No disobedience crosses his mind, only perfect obedience to the will of God. And it's not hard to imagine that Jesus was afraid, because all of a sudden God, who had been with him all of his life, he's not there. That sin finally separates him from his Father, just as it separates us from him. And in those final moments, Jesus cries out, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani? My God, why have you forsaken me?" Those last few moments in the garden, he begged for that cup to be passed from him, but said, "If it is your will, though, Father, let it be done." And he died. He said, "Now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out, and I, if I am lifted from the earth, will draw all peoples to myself." God sent his Son to die for us, the ultimate sacrifice. The war is over, and Christ has won. Satan, who had taken possession of the world when Adam and Eve obeyed him, has been given his eviction notice. Jesus sacrificed himself for us and died. We know what happened with Jesus' body. We know that it was placed in a tomb and carefully tended. And we know that he rose again and gives us life because of that. And I guess it was the sacrifice of Jesus that really made me think about the Anzacs. Because what I honour about the Anzacs is not the fact that they fought in a war or killed others, because I don't think we should glorify war. But I honour the fact that they stood up and said, "I'm willing to sacrifice myself for those that I love." Jesus said, "Greater love hath no man than he lay down his life." And that's what the Anzacs did. That's why I honour them today. Jesus now has no burial spot that we can point to, because he rose. It's a very different reason why we don't have a burial spot for Alexander. He rose from the dead after 3 days and was taken to heaven and now rules at his Father's side. He has had the victory. And while we wait for him to return, Satan futilely thrashes the tail of his around the earth. Alexander Rankin Macmillan went to another land and fought and died. Because of people like him, we enjoy the freedom that we have in our country now. Jesus stood up and said, I'll go and fight for them, and came here and died for us. He did exactly the same thing. His blood purchased our freedom. And I guess I'm proud of Alexander because he's my great-great-uncle. And on Anzac Day, I'm going to honour him. My family still has those medals that he won. And I'm going to honour him for the sacrifice that he made. But I'm also going to remember that greatest sacrifice of all that Jesus made for us. Jesus came to a land that he created that was made strange by sin. And because of him, we are reconciled with the Father. And by accepting the sacrifice that Jesus has made for us, we can have eternal life. He's won the ultimate victory. The war's won, but the battle continues. So I guess to invite you to stand up with Jesus and realize that he's won the battle and he has given us the victory.